This is the third day of this March 2016 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from previously, a book called The Way of Korean Zen, which is a collection of the teachings of the 20th century Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim. Here, this section of his talks is called Stages of Meditation, or his writings. I guess these aren't translated transcripts of his talks, but his actual writing. At least that's what it says on the cover. The author is Kusan Sunim. When people discuss the practice of meditation, they often refer to a person having either a superior, intermediate, or inferior task for capacity for this task. This goes back to this categorization goes back to the time of the Buddha himself. In a sutra, the Buddha uses this metaphor about, here it's four different types. The one who learns that someone in another village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it sees the shadow of the whip. The one who learns that someone in his own village is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the hair. The one who learns that someone in his family is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the flesh. And finally, the one who learns that he himself is about to die and reflects on the transient nature of all life is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the bone. So how close do we have to get to this fact of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of time of death? How close do we have to get to that experientially before we really get going and resolve to come to terms with life and death? And then in a koan, in the Mumonkan, the Buddha uses that. He's speaking with respect of a certain monk who came to awakening, and he says he's like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of a whip. So, in Kusan's terms, he says, when people discuss the practice of meditation, they often refer to a person having either a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. However, these capacities are not inborn qualities. That's the key thing. Even if one must make the mistake of categorizing oneself in one of these three, remember that these capacities are not inborn qualities. For once a strong motivation has been generated, then a person is immediately endowed with a superior capacity. So this is essential to understand this. So no matter how slowly we might start, no matter how obstructed we may feel or unmotivated, there is within us, every one of us, this first-class horse that moves at even the shadow of the whip. It's ready to go. The person with more obstructions than others, just has some clearing to do to reveal, to allow that horse to spring into action. It needn't take long. I've told the story about a fellow who came to Sesshin in about 1977, let's say, and really, it seemed it was not, it was premature for him to come to Sesshin. Someone, a supervisor, found him on day three reading the newspaper. In his job was to collect trash, and he had gotten caught in some newspaper that he found. But something dramatic changed in him shortly after that. And he actually was passed. He actually had a breakthrough in his koan. So don't make the mistake of selling yourself short, of thinking that there is any inherent handicap that you have. Remember, all of us is equally endowed with this enlightened nature. Just a matter of accessing it. And then he picks up, nevertheless, there are different levels of motivation. Some people may leave the care of their parents and relatives and become monks or nuns with the sincere motivation to realize Buddhahood. But after practicing for a while, they discover that the aim of meditation is not achieved as easily as cooling hot cereal by pouring cold water on it. Such persons may become disheartened when their practice does not proceed as smoothly as they'd expected. However, a person of superior capacity is able to completely cut off the mind of discrimination as soon as he is told to do so. But for those who are unable to do this, much hardship, effort, and total determination are needed before they can achieve this state. Most people who meditate on a koan intend at the outset to keep a firm hold on it. But usually, after a very short while, their koan disappears and they just lose themselves in delusive thoughts. If someone persists in such a way, when will he ever awaken? Others, after a few initial attempts to hold on to the koan, find that it does not appear to them spontaneously, so they just sit still without doing anything at all. Such people then ask me, "What do you claim there to be? Surely there is just nothing." This is a stance that seems to have been more of a problem in China and Korea and Japan than it is here, where people make this fatal error of just sort of distancing from everything and just saying, well, ultimately there's nothing at all. The problem here is that although they tried to hold on to the koan, they found nothing that they could take firm hold of, thus they conclude that there is nothing at all. But such conclusions are only reached intellectually. Indeed, as long as you continue just to scheme and conceptualize with the intellect, you will find nothing to take firm hold of. But to then proclaim that in reality there is just nothing is mere foolishness. To see for oneself the fundamental emptiness of all phenomena, the formlessness of all forms, all phenomena, is one thing. That's a genuine insight. But to get into this makyo, really, this makyo about seeing everything as nothing and then having it leave you indifferent to practice, that's just that. It's just a little trick of the mind, another of the mind's many gambits to stop you from exerting yourself. He continues, it is essential to take a firm hold of the koan and to continuously advance in your practice. This is the same whether you are investigating what is this, mu, or the cypress in the courtyard, another famous koan. Initially, you do not understand at all what is meant by these questions. Therefore, in order to fully understand their meaning, you must seize hold of the koan and penetrate deeply into it with incessant questioning. It is really very simple. You do not understand what is meant, thus it is necessary to find out through constant questioning. If you did understand, then, of course, there would be no need for any such questioning. The greatest disease that can affect someone who is meditating on a koan is the absence of any questioning. It is quite meaningless to simply repeat the koan mechanically in your mind without this sense of questioning. Now here, what I've learned in my 30 years of teaching is that it's not just you're not questioning and you're left with mechanically repeating it. There's a third way, which is really quite common, which is you're not doing it mechanically, but you're also not questioning. And that's a valid way to practice until you arouse this doubt sensation, the questioning. So I've learned from many people, honest, sincere people, that who say that, you know, the questioning just isn't there. You know, I wish it were, but they're just... it's just not actually a question for me. And what I've learned, and this actually goes back to my own experience working on Mu, is that, okay, that it's probably better for you not to try to force yourself into some kind of questioning, but rather than to just concentrate intensely on the word Mu. And when you reach a threshold, a depth of intimacy with the word Mu, in this case, when you become intimate with it, really intimate with it, then it blossoms into a question. That's when the questioning takes over. So I think that's better. Just settling for just this, and it's really almost as good as questioning. Almost, when you're really fiercely engaged, concentrated on the word, the single word, never mind the questioning. It's almost as good as the questioning. But it's true that really there is a turnabout in one's work on the koan when it becomes a question, a genuine question. And then it sort of works itself. It's not trying to contrive to make a question out of it. It's not artificially trying to manufacture it's genuine. It becomes puzzling. What is this Mu? What is it? can become desperate questioning. It can become questioning that's so strong that it's out of your hands. You can't lay it down. You couldn't lay it down if you wanted to. So, but the worst for sure is just to mechanically repeat it with your mind wandering as you just, you know, mentally murmur the mu or whatever the koan is. When you first try to meditate, you may find that no matter how strong your resolve is to firmly hold the koan, the mind is constantly besieged by wandering thoughts, and it seems impossible to progress in the practice. Besieged, it's a good word. We feel like we're under siege with these thoughts. Saint Augustine said, an ill-regulated mind is its own punishment. At such times, you must completely forget about what has happened in the past. For what benefit is there in continuing to think about things that have already ceased? Likewise, you should desist from speculating about what might happen in the future. For since it will be determined by various conditions, what can your present thoughts do to influence the course of future events? These are the two most common directions that the mind wanders, into the past or into the future. When we think about it, just using our reason for a minute, it is absurd to sit and think about the past or about the future, either one. And that means even if we've had some wonderful moments in the past, what good does it do to hold on to those? Even real insights. What are you doing thinking about those as this present moment passes you by? It's very tempting to think back, to recall some wonderful experiences of deep peace, tranquility, maybe even states of euphoria, rapture. But what are you doing? That's not what's real right here now. Sometimes people report an experience they had much earlier in their practice, or even before they began practicing Zen, something that happened to them when they were younger that they've now construed as an awakening of some kind. And I tell them, well, it's really impossible for me to assess what happened to you a year or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but it doesn't matter. Even if, in the unlikely possibility that we're what we would call in Zen a genuine awakening experience, well, it does no good to think about it. That was then. What have you done for me lately? Let it go. Even an experience of realization confirmed by a teacher is something to be let go of. Because really what we're talking about, if it's something in the past, is the memory of it, the thought of it. See some of these great masters like Hakuin, who would have one enlightenment experience after another, and realized as his practice matured that it's just something to discard. That is, the memory of it, the thought of it. So long as we're thinking of it, then what is that? It's just dwelling in thoughts, memories. Memories are thoughts. And then the same, of course, for the future. What good does it do to play out scenarios that might occur after Sesshin or next year, sifting through images and thoughts about what could happen, worrying about what might happen? David Mamet, the playwright, said, "Worry is just interest paid on a debt that never comes due." So, any intelligent person can see the futility of sitting on the mat and dwelling on in the past or in the future. And yet, the force of habit gets the better of us. Some memories just keep pestering us. Our anxieties about the future, financial or relationship issues about the future. We have to recognize that it does us no good to be dwelling in these kinds of thoughts, past or future. Not just that it does us no good, but that it's impeding our work in this most vital work of coming, seeing what is beyond past and future, beyond thought. We have to get to the point where we recognize there's nothing for us in our thoughts. Yes, there's a place for thinking. There's a place for consciously working out problems that have to be worked out. But this idle drifting into memories and into future scenarios, there's nothing. There's no good in that. This point he makes about the future, since it will be what will happen in the future will be determined by various conditions. What can your present thoughts do? This is a core teaching of the Dharma is that that it's not just what I'm going to do. But things unfold in accordance with various causes and conditions, primary causes and conditions. This is what slays me about these promises by presidential candidates of what they're going to do, because we know that there are so many factors, there are so many circumstances and other influences that can block a president from doing what he wants to do, what she wants to do. It's such an ego delusion to announce that I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Well, we all know this is part of how they sell themselves, but still, the people who believe this, who believe that, okay, if he says he's going to do that, that's the guy for me. Well, we learned these last 8 years how much more complicated it is than just the president's will. He continues, your sole function during a meditation session is to sit on the meditation cushion, investigate your koan, and awaken to its meaning. Other than this, there is nothing else to do. So why do you needlessly waste this precious time by entertaining thoughts about what has been and what might be? However, as soon as you manage to cut off all thoughts of the past and future, you will experience a state of emptiness. This occurs because at that moment, both before and after are severed. If you cannot reach this state because of an inability to control your thoughts about the past and future, then you cannot be considered a true practitioner. Remember, your sole responsibility is to awaken through inquiring into the koan. And for those doing a breath practice, your sole responsibility, of course, is to unite with the breath, become absolutely one with the breath. While sitting, and then when active, it's to become one with what you're doing. He continues, once before and after have been severed, you enter a state of emptiness. Now, at this time, there is a danger that you might easily slip into a state of just observing the emptiness. In such a condition, you are neither disturbed by sleepiness nor wandering thoughts, but in addition, the koan is also absent. This is a state that someone or a few people in every session get into, and they make the mistake of just savoring this state of emptiness and forgetting about the koan. It's a fatal mistake. If you just observe the emptiness in this way, you will become a spineless insect. Don't ask me to interpret that. Thus, it is a mistake to merely observe the emptiness. Moreover, you should not even allow the thought to arise that you are not observing it. Likewise, try to discard even the idea that you should not allow such a thought of not observing to arise. And finally, you should let go of that idea as well. We all know how these thoughts can recede, these thoughts of thoughts of thoughts. Seeing oneself, the receding, endlessly receding observer. This can be quite frustrating to always feel that there's you're split. There's the observer and the observed, and then there's the observer of the observer observing, and so forth. What do you do with those? That endlessly receding division of the mind, well, you just throw yourself into your practice. And then the time comes when all those complications just vanish. Is something similar that Yasutani Roshi addressed. He said one has to get rid of all concepts until nothing remains, then one has to rid himself of the idea that there's nothing. It's like doing cleaning with a bucket of water. After you have made everything spotless, you need to dispose of the dirty water that remains. So that dirty water is that remaining, that final concept is the concept of emptiness. You will then reach a point where all mental content is relinquished. At that time, all circumstances are absent, so if you take hold of the koan, it will appear with extreme vividness and clarity. By concentrating on the koan in this fashion for a period of a few days, a state of quiescence and vividness will begin to clearly emerge. At this time, there is the danger of easily succumbing to the misconception that you have awakened. However, this is not an experience of awakening. It is merely a perception of the luminous nature of consciousness. Again, this can be so tantalizing to just relish this luminous, empty stillness. But that luminous, empty stillness is a state of mind. Anything short of genuine awakening is a state, a passing state, and this is too. So at such a time, you have to recognize that it's a potential trap, and not settle for just blissing out in a state of emptiness. If at such a time you become distracted by circumstances, what is appearing to you will fade and finally become covered up. What is appearing to you is this original mind. Covered up, of course, by thoughts. Therefore, make a great effort not to be distracted and instead continue to hold on firmly to the koan. At this time, the koan is said to be ripening and the mind starts to become sharper and more single-pointed, like a fine sword. It is vital at this point to pursue your practice with the intensity of an attacking soldier. You must become totally involved with the koan to the exclusion of everything else. If you can make your body and mind become identical with the koan, then in the end, ignorance will naturally shatter. You will fall into a state of complete unknowing, perplexity, and questioning. But this is not a final or lasting state. When you have reached this point, you must still proceed further to the stage where, although you have ears, you do not know how to hear. Although you have eyes, you do not know how to see, and although you have a tongue, you do not know how to speak. To reach the place where mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers may entail several years of hard practice. Therefore, it is necessary to cast aside all other concerns and train yourself to focus the entirety of your attention on the tasteless koan alone. Tasteless. Who has not experienced the tastelessness, the tiresomeness of a koan, that is, who's worked on koans? Even Hakuin, as a teacher, would look back and recall those vile koans. Some people, they just can't hold up under facing that frustration. That's really what it is. It's just frustration. It's a test. It's a test of one's ability to persevere through the frustration. It's a test that every great achiever, certainly most obviously in athletics, sports, in music, many other fields, research, where you keep running into an impasse, and what do? Well, you go on. You press on. You find a way. He continues, by proceeding in this way, what is appearing will become even brighter. And after a short while, you will reach a state in which you cannot move an inch in any direction. Even if you wanted to, you could not go forward, nor backward, nor to the right, nor to the left. I remember this as, I remember thinking it's like being caught in a vice. Hakuin described it as being, feeling as though encased in a sheet of ice that extended 10,000 miles. Throughout, the koan remains clear, but you are simply unable to do anything. Moreover, although such a state has been reached, do not allow even the tiniest thought of having realized anything to occur. Such thoughts are a disease of the mind. Instead, in utmost earnestness, hold firmly to the koan and continue with the meditation. With such efforts, you will find that even without consciously raising the koan, it will be present of its own accord. And without consciously thinking of the koan, the awareness of it will always be there. At this time, when you sit, the koan sits. When you stand, the koan stands. And when you lie down, the koan lies down. When this occurs, you can truly say that the koan is present everywhere and that the practice is progressing well. Nevertheless, you must continue to persevere diligently, for there still is the danger of regressing. Upon reaching such a state, it is important to consult a wise teacher about how to proceed further with the practice. Because, on the one hand, it is easy to mistake such experiences for an awakening, and, on the other, you simply may be at a loss as to what should next be done. Now, a wise teacher in this case is one who is able to clearly show the way ahead so that your practice can progress. However, there are some teachers who, through a lack of understanding, will tell you to select another koan at this point. But this is not good advice, and such persons are unwise teachers. At this time, that which stands between yourself and awakening is as thin as a single sheet of white paper. At this time, you need to proceed with the same keen determination and enthusiasm as a beginner. Now the moment has come to raise the final resolve. At the outset of the practice, your resolve can be compared to soaking the straw with which to make sandals in water. Now, as the practice approaches its goal, your final resolve must be similar to that of someone who has to slash through an impossible knot with a single stroke of his sword. All other concerns must be indiscriminately cast aside. If you are to die, then you will die. If you are to live, then you will live. Through developing such determination, the task can now be completed within 1 week. Thus, realizing this to be a very critical moment, you should prepare yourself with all intensity for one more bout. This, then, is the final resolve. This thing about if you're going to die, you'll die. There's, of course, no chance of literally, physically dying. But when one reaches this point, you do have a sense of being on the verge of death. Of course, the death is the death to the ego, to the self, or attachment to the self. But it is, can be experienced as being on the verge of death. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.